Hey, I'm Zach, and one day I'm going to make movies, but right now I'm young, dumb, and not nearly as good-looking as my co-hosts. So with the help of...
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
I'm Steven.
I'm going to learn what makes a movie great by watching all the classics I've skipped over. So pop the corn and turn your cell phone to silent, because it's time for a new episode of Zach on Film. Let's all run away from our rich fathers and take a bus up to the big city. Along the way, let's learn a bit about ourselves, learn the proper way to hitchhike, and fall in love with a newspaper writer. Make sure to bring your listening device on this flight of love to this week's Zach on Film as we talk It Happened One Night.
You can pick up It Happened One Night from the Amazon link at majorspoilers.com. Pick up It Happened One Night in HD and enjoy this 1934 classic from Frank Capra.
Wow. Was it originally shot in HD?
It was originally shot in HD. Film is
full frame.
Full frame HD.
Frank Capra was a vision.
It's actually sized down from 2K.
Yes, exactly. Probably was.
What the hell does that? What?
So, Zach, fill us in on It Happened One Night.
So, It Happened One Night came out in 1934.
Mm-hmm.
A long time ago. It's a story of a rich young daughter. She wanted to get away from her father's ruling of her life. So she decided to leave and go to her love. Along the way, she has to take a bus. A bus. And she's rich. Like a bus? Yuck.
Well, she doesn't want to be picked up. She doesn't want to be hijacked by the Pinkertons.
She's got to be smart about this. So she takes a bus.
Well, no one expects the Spanish Inquisition.
No.
No one expects a Greyhound.
Chief weapon is fear.
This reporter quit his job because he sticks it to the man because he's cool and stuff. And he's
also drunk.
Yeah, well, he's drunk. And would you happen to know it, these two cross paths. And they take a ride across the southern states all the way up to the big city of New York from Florida.
Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert. What a great pair.
Yeah.
I forgot how it has probably been 20 years since
Gable's
I watched.
Pretty awesome as well.
It's been 20 years since I've watched this movie, and I forgot how wonderful it is. I mean, and then I guess
Claudette
I would
Colbert
say
has awesome legs. That's all I'm saying.
I would say do check this out in HD, because the last time I watched this, it was on VHS, and man, this looked really good in the cleaned up print, black and white. That this was.
I think we saw the same version, and I recall it being kind of gray and muddy.
Yeah. We watched it in film school.
When we saw it in college.
Yeah. Frank Capra, of course, It Happened One Night. Most people know him from that. Really didn't think that this movie was a success for him. When it was originally released, it got mediocre reviews from critics. The box office in the first, I think, 5 weeks really didn't do anything. It was just kind of stagnant.
Were they upset that someone only hits a woman once in it?
No. In fact, we'll get to that a little bit later on. But what ended up happening is when it went into the secondary theater, essentially today's dollar theater, word of mouth started spreading. People were like, oh, you got to see this. In fact, Colbert was like, oh, I can't believe I was in this terrible, terrible movie. It'll never do anything for me. And then all of a sudden, it started getting this grassroots effort, and people just started going to it and seeing it in droves, and it caught like wildfire, and is only one of four films, I believe, to win what is essentially the Triple Crown. It won
five Oscars
in the main category, Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Actress, and
screenplay.
I think Best Screenplay. And the next time that happened was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and then with... Silence of the Lambs and
I forget the
Titanic, I think. Yeah. So, I mean, there's very few films to have done that. And, Colbert wasn't even really planning on going to the Oscar ceremony. She was going to be out of town. And then when they found out that she won, the head of the studio went and made sure that somebody went down to the train station, yanked her off the train and brought her to the awards ceremony. So, you know, this film, there's something about this story, Zach, and what is it that makes it so interesting?
Was that a question to me? Or
is
that a question that you're going to answer?
No.
Well, I think it's interesting because it makes it seem... It shows a story of what we believe of, like, love, a random encounters of love, and then this fantasy unfolding that you find the perfect person for you, and then life will never be bad again because you found that person. And it's not, I mean, it's just a random a thing on a bus. I think that's why people like it.
You're most recently in love and got engaged. Is that how it was when you met your fiance?
Yes. I was, my parents.
She doesn't
like,
listen
you
to
need
this.
To, you need to stay here in this small town. I was like, no, Mom, I'm going to make it big in the city. And I took a bus 45 minutes to Hayes. And there I found her.
At this rate, Zach will be in New York by the time he's 45.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
Yep.
So is it just this happenstance of finding love? Is that what makes this story sell?
Well... That, and I mean, when you look at it, it's essentially, I don't know if there, I'm sure there might have been a movie done this before, but certainly stories of love before this. It sets up the two opposing mindsets and then makes them be together and like realize they're different and they hate each other, but they love each other, and then bad things happen, but then they realize their love and come together, or the plot of most rom-coms now.
Well, and this is where we get the romantic comedy,
that,
right?
Sure. And I think people like that. I mean, we gravitate towards stories that we find familiar and that make us feel happy. I mean, these are a happy plot line. So that's nice.
Rodrigo, give us some more like detail about the screwball comedy and the rom-com.
Right, so there's a few things that were popular in those days as far as comedies. You needed to have snappy dialogue, which this clearly has.
Oh, yeah?
Ah, yeah? How about I do this instead? which this definitely has. Also... kind of these very unusual situations manifesting, as well as like goofy side characters, and which this also has plenty of. Although I felt that what I really liked about it is that they kept the goofy side characters very much under control.
Oh, sure.
Like there's a recurring character that's kind of annoying, but he's supposed to be annoying.
Mm-hmm. Smedley or whatever his name was.
Yeah, and then like all the other people that are like the random hotel owners and bus drivers and people that they meet that are just like, why does this character have such a weird voice? So that's
how people talked in the 30s.
Yeah, and it kind of is. I think to a large degree, when you watch a screwball comedy or a comedy from the 30s, you see this and it's like, is that how people in the 30s talked? And the answer is, of course, no. That's how people in the 30s wish they talked.
Yeah.
Because it is, you know, really tight writing and everybody's really smart. You know, the main characters are really smart. Their opposition is really smart. Everybody's just throwing zingers at each other back and forth.
Right.
It's good times. Now, as far as a romantic comedy, this is the plot line that you see over and over again, like we've said. But It Happened One Night has some things that, for better or for worse, don't get duplicated too often.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the ending is, to me, was a little off-putting.
Oh, which part of it?
The fact that basically after she runs away, we actually never see them together.
Well, and there's a reason for that, and we'll get to that here in a little bit as well. But you're right, I can see that being off-putting.
Yeah.
I guess you do actually, like, it's interesting to see individual scenes in this and how they get echoed in romantic comedies across the ages. Because there's the scene in the bus where everybody's singing, and you can see that in My Best Friend's Wedding.
And you can see it in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Yep. You can see this little singing scene that keeps happening. You can see it in that one where, like, that one leap year, leap day, something like that. It's like this chick is going to propose to her fiance, but instead she meets a handsome European guy and they go on a road trip together. It's basically the same way as the exact same movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, like smack in the middle, singing scene.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like you see this happen over and over and over across history. It's like every romantic comedy, it's actually, it happened one night.
You've Got Mail, does it have a singing song in it?
I don't think I've seen that. You've Got Mail.
I don't think it does.
Interesting. So, Matthew, what is
Fools Rush In?
Oh, is that it? Okay.
There you go.
Has that one does have a slightly different spin because it's the it's the My Big Fat Ex Wedding, right?
Oh, sure, sure.
It's like this one's My Big Fat Mexican Wedding. Of course, came out before My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
There you go, Matthew. What is special in the storytelling that Capra is bringing to screen beyond just we've set up a formula that has been copied again and again and again?
Well, I think that is a big part of it. I mean, this is almost the prototypical movie that romantic comedies want to be. Mm. But when you really break it down, what you've got here is a clearly told story. It's a story that doesn't have a whole lot of happy dappy stuff going to it. It's got the moments where I sit here and I think, hey, I think I saw that in a Bugs Bunny short once, to where it's actually become something that is archetypical. I don't know really if I entirely understand your question.
Well, I mean, are there certain themes, elements, et cetera, that makes this story special? You're right. It is a very straightforward, plain story. Girl doesn't want to be living under her father's rule. She had eloped with this air magnate, and so she decides to run off to be with King Windsor, or whatever his name was.
Wesley.
And so in order to do that, she has to get
as
to New York.
You wish.
In order to go undercover as much as she can, she has to travel by bus. There she meets a newly unemployed drunkard reporter who likes her attitude, and the two start to fall for one another, even though what he sees in her is an opportunity to get a job back and make a name for himself and make lots of money, not by turning her in, but by telling the story that he knows is hidden right there. So, you know, he's being very opportunistic, but by the time he reaches the end of the movie, he realizes, oh, these 3 days that I've spent with this person, I've totally fallen in love with them, and I want to be with her, but I can't because she's already married. And man, I just want my $34 that I spent on her, and I'll go.
Right.
And then, of course, we have a very familiar runaway bride scenario where she gets to the altar, and her father's like, you know, if you want to get away from King Wesley, Pierce or whatever his name is, really is in love with you. Clark Gable really is in love with you. You should go with him, and I'll be okay with that, and I'll clean up the mess. And she gets up there, and she decides, yep, that's it. I'm out of here, and she runs off. And this is the part of the story where, Rodrigo, you get rather annoyed. But we do see, again, these little simple elements, this love at first sight, this turnabout where the strong female character is still in need of help, and the two have the snappy dialogue and banter back and forth with one another. And I think it all comes together.
Did you ever go see Don John? The Joseph Gordon-Levitt written, directed?
Oh, no, I have not. That's the guy that's addicted to porn.
Right, right. Yeah. And there's a sequence in that movie where his girlfriend wants to go to some romantic comedy, and he can't stand it because then he breaks it down, and they show the movie on screen. It's actually played by Channing Tatum and Anne Hathaway, which I thought that these are the modern day those people from this movie,
right.
And they just break down like this is a romantic comedy. He just shows all the beats of the movie, and it just shows the girl wide eyed. It's about the movie, but it's like this is a romantic comedy. He just says this is what people want, and this is what they're given,
and that's what we see in this movie, right? It's all played out here,
and so this is where it started.
So the thing that in this movie, it is the 1930s. It's not like a guy and a girl just jump in bed and say, oh, well, we're not going to touch one another, even though there's a single bed in the room. They make very clear in this movie that there are separate beds. And to make sure that there's no impropriety, Clark Gable does this routine where he hangs a rope and a blanket in between their two beds so they don't have to see each other while they're undressing or have any lustful thoughts or whatever that goes through young people's minds of that time period. And so everything is above board. Everything's above code. At the end of the movie, she runs off and we cut to another roadside hotel, and the running gag of the horns of Jericho are going to blow this wall down and we can get it on. We don't get to see that happen because, again, kissing, there may be something in the mindset that, remember, she is divorced now, or the wedding was annulled. Mm-hmm. So it didn't happen. But up until that point, she is still wed up until they get the telegram. So I think, Rodrigo, the fact that we don't see them in that last 5 minutes, mm-hmm. just to see them embrace, I think is enough to keep it, again, somewhat clean.
Yeah.
But this movie is still very risque for the time period.
That's what I thought when I was watching. I was like,
oh,
they're pushing some boundaries here.
So talk about some of the boundaries that you thought were being pushed by for the 1930s.
Well, there's the roadside, let me show you how to pick up a car scene,
where
she just kind of hikes up her dress a little bit and the car stops automatically. You talked about how they put up the blanket when they undress in the cabin, but when I say nowadays, if I said, oh, they showed her undressing, you would think, oh, she was naked at the end of this scene. But in 1930s terms, she might have been naked to some people.
I mean, she drips down to a slip. Yeah. And Clark Gable's taking off his shirt.
Right.
Yeah.
The story goes that because he's topless in that scene, the sales of men's undershirts started to decline after that because of that scene.
Clark Gable was cool.
Right.
Yeah.
And he didn't wear an undershirt in that scene because it was messing up his blocking.
Mm.
He was trying to do the scene and keep his fast-talking high trousers, and he couldn't do it with the undershirt, so he didn't wear the undershirt for the scene.
Hmm.
I don't know if that's an urban legend about the sales dropping, but you hear that a lot.
Yeah. And of course, they get into some very close, almost kissing situations. You have to remember, she's married throughout this movie. She is already married. And so here is someone who is on the verge of an affair, which would be a big no-no under the Hays Code and the code of the time.
When,
would this be a Hays Code movie?
It is very close to it, and I'm looking up the exact information here because that's what I was getting to. So, Rodrigo, go ahead and take it away.
When they think they're going to get made, he kneels down and unbuttons her shirt.
Oh, yeah.
He messes up her hair and he unbuttons her shirt,
too. Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on where I was like, you go, filmmakers of the time.
Yeah. Which I thought that scene was interesting because they go through this whole process of putting this sheet up so they don't see each other undressed. But
and then
moment of crunch, I'm unbuttoning your shirt, and she doesn't protest at all.
I'm grabbing your chest and going to town. No, so the Hays Code, Matthew, is the Motion Picture Production Code, which was in place from 1930 until 1968. So the thing was, when this was first put into place in the 1930s, the Hays Code was not heavily enforced. I mean, there would be some things that you could do and some things that they probably turned a blind eye to or were still trying to figure out what was going on. After this movie came out, people started cracking down and following the Motion Pictures production guide a lot closer to prevent a lot of this risque material. But you're right. A woman hiking her leg up and saying, hey, you know, this idea of sex is getting me what I want. Very ahead of its time for 1934.
I mean, that would be risque for 1954. Reportedly, from what I understand, she actually wasn't going to do that. They were going to have to bring in a body double before the actress agreed to do that scandalous moment and then pull over the skipper's father.
Yeah,
as she does. Which,
Alan Hale.
Yeah. Yeah, Alan Hale. And of course, you know, his son pretty much looks exactly
well, and
like
I know,
him.
And that's
so
why I kept going. It's like,
is that,
wait a minute, Alan Hale or Alan Hale Jr.? What is the skipper doing driving that car and singing about young love and ripping people off on the road?
Shouldn't the skipper? Well, and it's one of those things. That's one of those moments where, you know, in my mind when I was younger, the skipper was just this eternal white-haired fat man, which is really what I want to grow up to be. But this movie strikes a really, really good balance between the comedy and the romance. And I think part of that may be that Hays Code of there was a limit of what they thought they could get away with, to where, you know, you don't necessarily have that problem, say, of Juno, which is a movie that I like as well, that follows this same prompt, but it starts with the characters having already done all sorts of, you know, sexual stuff at least once. you have that thing where all of that is kind of kept. It's definitely subsumed in everything that happens in the story, but it's kind of kept to a level where it actually feels like they don't really know each other, and they clearly have an attraction, but they're both afraid to act on it because they really can't show it in the movies, or they shouldn't show it in the movies for fear of it not playing in Peoria.
Let me ask you guys this. Is Clark Gable's character in this movie the inspiration for Bugs Bunny?
Vocally?
No, not vocally.
Yes.
Okay.
The eating the carrot and the talking real fast.
He eats the carrot, talks real fast. Someone keeps referring to him as Doc all the time. You know, Shapley keeps referring to him as Doc. His patter.
Is Friz Freleng's favorite movie.
Yes, it is. And Clark Gable may be the inspiration for Bugs Bunny.
Wow.
Or at least in this role for that. And I find that fascinating because that Bugs Bunny didn't appear until 1940.
Don't they reference a character named Bugs in the film?
No, there's
Bugs Dooley.
Well, there's Bugs Dooley, but there's also you know, the Shapely guy keeps calling everybody Doc and keeps calling the Clark Gable's character Doc. So I find that very fascinating. Crazy.
Yeah, it's one of those things that when you start finding stuff like this out, it's interesting because we expect that Bugs Bunny is eternal, right? Like,
yes,
he has no beginning, but yes. he did. Like this movie comes from a world from before Bugs Bunny existed. This movie,
which is crazy, because it's like, wait a minute, how can Clark Gable be the inspiration for Bugs Bunny? Because I know I've seen Bugs Bunny cartoons that Clark Gable is in, so therefore Bugs Bunny had to have been around since the 1920s, right. And that's like before Clark Gable. 1940 is when Bugs Bunny came out. So yeah, I mean it makes a lot of sense.
And I believe in his first appearance, he was Ephraim the brain damaged rabbit.
Clark Gable, something Bugs like Bunny. That.
Either or.
Anyway.
Actually, it's funnier if it's Clark Gable.
Anyway, why don't we thank some of our associate producers?
Yes, let's shout out to our associate producers. Alexander Deshaun, Amber Danette, Christopher Matthias, Josh Pine, Daniel Auger, Paul Fassett, Linscog Severin, Robert Kaslick, Robert Laville, and Patrick Marr. Thank you for being associate producers.
He sounds like somebody from the 1930s.
Yes. Helps me pronounce names.
Yeah, right?
Helps me pronounce names.
Those are our associate producers. That's okay, Zach.
And we want to thank all of our associate producers, those people who have become VIP members over at members.majorspoilers.com. Every little bit helps make
Very
sure that this
producers.
Show continues on and on and on.
Absolutely.
So, Zach, talk to us about technical stuff. What kind of things did you pick up technically, or what things did you notice technically about this film that may have been flawed in places?
Well, let's just start there. Let's start with the things that I noticed that were not so good.
Okay.
The editing was a little jarring.
It was.
Because it was not, the cuts weren't synced together perfectly. They weren't cut on
They
the
weren't
action.
Matching their action. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the one really noticeable place is when at the first hotel and Gable's taking off his clothes and eventually he's going to take off his pants and you see her jump a little bit and then they do the cut and then it's her starting to run like she hasn't even ran yet.
Right.
And then you started running. But then there's just little tiny ones where hand movements just aren't quite right, but they're noticeable because his arm will jump. And there was just a few places. I know really in the beginning, I felt like the editing was off a little bit. And then towards the end, there were some more spots. And it's just, it's interesting. I mean, we talk about editing, and I know it's like a frame thing. Like a 24th of a second outcome makes such a big difference. Just one fraction of a second.
People catch it. I mean, you can see it. And you don't have to be trained to see it.
No.
You have to be trained to pay attention to it to a certain degree because people are very forgiving.
Sure.
If you see something that doesn't match, you like immediately forget it as you know, to allow the movie to progress.
And sometimes those are just simple continuity errors. In one of the upcoming bonus tracks or in one of the bonus tracks episodes that we've recorded about Buckaroo Banzai, there's a shot where the bad guys step out from behind the curtain and one of them's Christopher Lloyd. And the way that the scene's edited, in one shot, he's wearing his glasses. You cut to a different angle and he doesn't have his glasses. And then you cut back and his glasses are back on his face again. Those kinds of things happen quite a bit. But in this case, with the matching of the action, not so good in a lot of places. And catching those things could be just being very aware of it, but also our own persistence of vision will catch a lot of those kinds of things. When they were trying to, when they were editing Terminator 2, Cameron was trying to figure out how they could get this down to under 3 hours or whatever it was.
Right.
And he came up with this wacky idea that what would happen if we edited out one frame of the movie every second, 29 frames instead of 30 frames, the length of the film by default, by just taking out that one frame every second or every 10 seconds or whatever it was, 5 seconds, I forget what it was.
It's 1 second per 30 or per 24 yeah, seconds. Yeah. So
he was going to take these out one every second and thought that by that time it would accumulate and bring the length of the movie down to under 2 hours. But when you watch that done, it is awful. It does not make any sense because all of a sudden you see people jumping around and you see these odd jumps in editing. So, you know, even at 20 or 30 frames a second or even 60 today with our HD captures, man, you're going to notice any little break in that continuity of motion.
And that's the thing is editing is something that is for humans. It's the editing techniques that we have and the editing techniques that are accepted. Yeah, there are things like pans and or not pans, but like dissolves and wipes and things like that we've agreed mean certain things, right? There's actually no reason why a clock wipe suggests time other than it's arbitrary. We've seen it so many times and it's a good thing because it's a clock and blah, 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 and it's resonant, but there's no reason why that should be. But close edits like that back and forth, they do have to follow how people believe the universe works. If they don't, it's jarring, and that's something that you have to pay attention to. It's like a black frame in between edits. Mm-hmm. You know, when you see that that flash of black, all of a sudden it can be, and usually you'll just go right through it, but you know, like there's something, and your eye catches it.
Yeah, it's the whole Tyler Durden insert porn into the PD movie.
Oh yeah, yeah. You really notice it. You do catch it. You do catch it even without realizing it. Mm-hmm. What else technically
bad? Or just anything. No, okay. I mean, no. So that was the only thing that I thought was bad. A technique that they use multiple times to show newspapers is they'll kind of just go to the newspaper and they'll hold it for like 2 or 3 seconds. Mm-hmm. And I think that maybe not the lingering on the item, but it's certainly a technique used by certain filmmakers. They'll in a conversation. And they'll just go to a shot of like the cup someone's about to drink, but like over the top shot, like straight down to the cup. Mm-hmm. Who am I thinking of? Who did The Departed? Scorsese.
Stone?
Scorsese. No. Is that right?
I think we'll look.
So, yeah.
Yeah. But doesn't he does? I feel like he does that a lot in The Departed.
Matt Damon. No, wait.
Yeah, Matt Damon.
Martin Scorsese.
Yeah, Scorsese. Well, he'll do that. And people having conversations, someone will reach for a cup, but it'll just go to like a straight over the top shot of the cup. And I don't know if that started here. I'm sure it probably didn't start here. And
you never know.
Maybe it could have.
I'll do a search real quick. But the newspaper flyout kind of stuff is pretty typical.
Yeah,
but, that spinning newspaper stuff has been around for a long time. Oh, actually, show somebody holding that paper.
Yeah.
Maybe specific to here.
Right. So that technique, I've picked up on from some people. And another thing, I know we talked about in The Artist a couple podcasts ago, how to recreate a time period through film and looking at the lighting and the framing and everything. And I know we brought up aspect ratio, and that made me think, just because this film is kind of more in a boxy aspect ratio. And I was thinking in the new, director's name's not doing very, what's the new Grand Budapest Hotel?
Oh, you're,
what's his name?
Wes Anderson.
Yeah, Wes Anderson. I know in the trailer for it, they show like 3 different aspect ratios in the trailer. Mm-hmm. They said that the film takes place over 3 different time periods.
Yeah.
And he changes the aspect ratio to show you what time period he's actually in the film. So, we see things like that. And the aspect ratio certainly changes. it dates a film.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
I mean, you know, we don't, people generally don't like box aspect ratio.
Although it's not a direct thing. It's not like aspect ratios get wider.
No.
They actually get wider, like, and then shrink again, and then get wider.
They get wider like my waistline. Over time, they just get wider and wider and wider. No,
and then they get really self-conscious, and they start shrinking again.
Yeah, I haven't realized that part yet. Or my waist hasn't, at least.
My waist is always in Panaflex.
In the reason, and we've talked before about why that aspect ratio changed, right? I mean, it's television.
Television
had a 4:3 ratio. It happened one night, had a 4:3 ratio. Very easy to put this on television. Mm-hmm. We want to compete with television. We'll go for the wider aspect ratio. The other thing I wanted to see if you noticed was the lighting and how they used lighting. This is a movie that is classic Hollywood lighting, where everybody, no matter where they're at, even with the lights are out, have a rim light.
Yeah.
And that just, even today, still tickles me every time I watch a movie, or especially an old movie, where it's just like, we have to rim this person so that their hair lights up, even though it's the middle of the night and the ceiling is in place on this building. There's nowhere that light could be coming from, yet we have that rim light on people.
I also find it interesting. I think it has some very theatrical scenes, but it also has some very... I guess television-y scenes. You know, there's a lot of close-ups, but there's a few scenes where you're basically just looking at a whole room, and maybe you just pan a little bit,
right?
Just kind of back and forth, like cut a little bit. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But mostly, you're watching two characters in the same room moving around. It's an interesting way of doing it, and I couldn't tell you if it's just that, you know, the cinema hadn't fully shed all of its theatrical roots, or if this was actually them going back and being like, okay, well, the best way to shoot the scene
is a wide shot.
Yeah.
And it depends, too, on the time periods. I know that when the first time that you cut to a close-up, people in certain regions of the country and the world were very upset, because it's like, you're expecting us to pay full price and we're only seeing half of a man.
Yeah.
You know, those were some of the outrage that audiences had. How dare you show me that man's face? I want to see his whole body.
Yeah.
But you're right, from a theatrical standpoint. I have to go back and look more on Frank Capra, because if you go and look, It's a Wonderful Life, he does a lot of these same things throughout his films, where it seems to be, keep it wide, let the audience partake everything, let the actors interact in the scene.
Right, let them move around.
But when it is time to do something important, let's go in for that close-up. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Kind of a car chase.
Well, yeah, a man running after a car is kind of a car chase, right? Steals their bags, has to go tie the poor man up to a tree. No, but you're talking about the end where Clark Gable's in this rickety old car, and it's overheating, the tire's flat, and he's trying to chase down the cops and his runaway bride, or the woman that he loves to get her back. Yeah, that's pretty good.
I know in an age of film, to make the actors look softer, they used to put like Vaseline and stuff on the lens.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't tell if they were actually doing that in this, or if like the film had kind of worn down, but I felt like there were some really soft spots.
When you see a close up of a well-known actress, and you'll see this happen a lot when we watch Sunset Boulevard. But when you do shots, especially old Hollywood style movies, you do soften that lens on the female actress to make her look more glamorous, to make that light glow. And you can do it by smearing Vaseline on the, not on the lens, Zach.
Don't do that.
Smear it onto a, if you're going to do it, which I don't recommend that you do, do it on a glass plate in front of the lens. Yeah. Today, if we're going to do something like that, we use a diffusion filter. And the diffusion filter is just there to diffuse that light. And there's a couple of ways you can do it. You can have a netting. And if you've seen a net gel, it actually looks like a little net that's been crisscrossed throughout the piece of glass that you slip it in. And because that glass is so close to the front, it's out of focus when you're shooting. But because the light is coming through and hitting either a white diffusion or a black diffusion, it's causing that light to scatter in certain ways. The cheaper way to do this, and I did this with some of my students years and years and years ago, is we looked at a $250 diffusion gel filter. Yeah. And then I said, well, go out and just buy a pair of Hanes nude white and black stockings, and you stretch it, literally stretch it over the front of the lens. Now, some photographers will actually stretch it behind the lens, between the lens and the sensor, mm-hmm. right? So they'll actually kind of screw it in place. And you can buy little filters that go on between the lens and the CCD or the imaging chip.
Be careful, though. Don't just be taking out the lens.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty dangerous. So you can get the same effect by just taking a pair of your fiance's sheer pantyhose and just stretch them really tight over the lens and, you know, rubber band them down so they're not sliding, and you'll get that same effect.
Interesting.
So there you go, listeners.
DIY. You can use them also to use the pain in horseback riding.
And you can just get a pair of the pantyhose with the cotton crotch and put them on your head and run around town in the middle of the night. That's also good for a laugh too.
That's what I do.
Oh, man, we really should have gotten out more in college, shouldn't we?
Anything else, Zach? Tell us what else that you picked up or learned.
Well, I was interested in this idea of romantic comedies stemming off from this movie, and so I thought, well, it kind of felt like the right time for most romantic comedies. So I went through a list of romantic comedies.
Okay,
this one was 1 hour and 45, so it was 105 minutes. I went and grabbed a list. Romantic comedy, some from this year and some big ones from last year. Warm Bodies was 98 minutes. The To-Do List was 105. Admission with Tina Fey and Paul Rudd was 107. About Time was a little longer, 123. Pretty Woman was 119. Sleepless in Seattle was the exact same at 105. I don't know if this means anything, but I thought it was interesting, so I looked it up.
It does. That's actually a really good observation, Zach.
And you're doing this based on just the last couple of years, right? I mean, you didn't go back and look at the best romantic comedies from
the last couple of years. He said Sleepless in Seattle.
Sleepless
in
Seattle was 105. Mm-hmm. You've Got Mail was 119. How's the Guy in 10
So they're getting
Days,
shorter.
About Time is that time travel one.
Is that one out yet? Is that on the iTunes yet?
I don't think it's coming in theaters yet.
I think it's on the iTunes pretty
soon.
Is it?
Oh, good.
I think you can pre-order.
It's 123.
Okay.
But yeah, that looks really good. I'm totally going to watch that.
Me too. Yeah. I mean, romantic.
Oh, I'm going to watch.
Blah, blah, blah.
I'm going to watch.
Blow things up.
Die Hard 19.
Yeah. Beard.
Let's go
nachos.
Lift something.
Nachos.
So did your fiance watch this?
She watched about the first 15 minutes of it. And the only thing she said is, how come everyone in this time period all talk the same? She said, like, Dorothy in Wizard of Oz talks just like that girl. I said, well, it's kind of just that time period, I guess. I don't know. I told her I'd ask. Do you guys know why everyone sounded the same in the 30s?
Because, see, everybody has to sound alike.
Partially because that's the writing that's popular.
Sure.
It's like...
everybody had the same acting and voice dictation coach.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and I mean, it's like... like when people showed up to audition, they were like, can you do this? Can you do this voice?
Yeah.
And the ones that could got cast, and the ones that couldn't didn't.
Your time notification, or
can
your time,
you talk the way people expect you to go?
Your time noticing, are you saying that this film was too long?
I kind of felt like it was long.
I think it drags in the middle.
I think it could have lost like 10 minutes or something.
Okay. And what are you going to take away from this and apply? Anything?
I'm going to take away the make sure your edits are tight and right lesson. And learn from old movies. They will make you successful.
Well.
Like all romantic.
I think.
They could.
I mean, there's something to this movie, right? This movie has been repeated 1,000 times.
Right. A million
right,
times.
Right.
Why? Like sitting down and trying to figure out what is it? What are the individual things in this movie that get repeated? And how? Why are they successful? And why have they been successful for the past 1,000 years?
80 yes. years.
Forever.
All right, Zach, wrap us up and get us
okay. That's it for this week's Zach on Film. Make sure to head over to majorspoilers.com and find that podcasting posting page where you can share all of your thoughts on It Happened One Night. While you're at majorspoilers.com, make sure to click on that amazon.com link where you can go buy this movie and Blu-ray players and all of your Christmas goods. That's coming up, you know. It won't cost you any extra, but a little bit will come back to us to help these shows keep on going. next week we are not having a show because it is the holidays here in America. So go eat a turkey and do not punch anyone when you go buy your Black Friday deals.
So,
punch a turkey.
The best time of the holidays when kids do eat the turkeys is they overdose on the tryptophan and they take a long nap and it's quiet. And it's quiet. It's and quiet almost, made me think.
It's legalized drugging of children.
And it made me think that maybe we should do a silent film, a true silent film. So you have the choice, Zach. I will give you the choice between City Lights or The Kid. Both of them Charlie Chaplin movies, both of them silent films, or I'm sorry, Modern Times or The Kid.
Yeah, Modern Times.
Yeah, Modern Times is what we were talking about earlier. Modern Times or The Kid.
Oh, I was really going to go with that Modern Lights one. That sounded interesting.
Yeah, that one's also...
But let's see here. What are my options? The Kid or...
Modern Times.
Modern Times or The Kid.
Let's go Modern Times.
Okay, that'll be in 2 weeks.
There you go. That'll be in 2 weeks, everyone. See you next time on Zach Hunter.